come back, why don't we begin with just a 5 minute sit just to collect ourselves? So again, just finding a posture for your body that feels alert and soft. And feeling yourself grounding. Maybe taking just one or two, just slightly fuller breaths. Maybe integrating, unifying body, mind, and present moment. Softening any places of holding. Tuning into the landscape of your body, however it is just now. Palpating the body with mindfulness, with kindness. Tuning into the landscape of your mind heart just now, however it is, whatever thoughts, whatever moods are present, just simply knowing them with an affectionate curiosity. Breathing into the body, breathing into the mind, spaciousness, calming. Grounding. Thank you. So welcome back. I hope you feel somewhat refreshed. So I'd like to move on and reflect upon this next of the seven treasures, this limb of awakening, this quality of heart-mind. The Pali is Pasadi, which translates as tranquility. Actually, it's most accurately translated as tranquilizing, which on first hearing doesn't sound like a very attractive practice, like something like we might do to an animal. But here we're not talking about a bovine tranquility. But reflecting on what this quality is really pointing to in terms of our capacities for calming, for stilling, for grounding. When we become somewhat familiar with the landscape of the veiling factors of craving, ill will, agitation, numbness, doubt, I think we can sense the agitation that is held within them. The craving for sensual pleasure makes us so busy. Ill will makes us busy with aversion and the endeavor to fix things. How restlessness and worry stirs our bodies and our minds, and how doubt just preoccupies us. I think the only veiling factor that really doesn't hold this feature of agitation is dullness and numbness, but I think this is hardly an enticing prospect as a way to live. When our bodies, and they do, become agitated, contracted, stressed, and our minds proliferate stories, narratives about the past, about the future, and about the present, and agitation is the fuel for proliferation, the ongoing production of thought that we can become so lost in or overwhelmed by. And of course, the Pali word for this proliferation that many of you will be familiar with is papancha. The generation of thinking based on underlying tendencies and patterns that distorts our capacity to see things as they actually are. Another of the synonyms for nibbana is nipapancha, the end of proliferation. Papancha, or proliferation, this tendency of generating narratives and stories about pretty much anything and anyone. This is the stuff of self-making. And this is the stuff of making of the other. Agitation is the qualitative tone of identification and self-making. Just as our minds and bodies can be shaped by the veiling factors, our world too can be shaped by craving, by ill will, by agitation, numbness, and doubt. And this is really the stuff of nightmares. It's the landscape of distress. I think the first job of every meditator is to begin to calm the agitation. The first instructions in the Satipatthana Sutta, the teaching of mindfulness, the Buddha says, breathing in, calming the formations. Breathing out, calming the formations. And the formations, of course, are the repetitive patterns of reactivity, the obsessions and preoccupations, the busyness, the narratives, and the agitation. This, I think, is such a challenge for us. We also live in a world that is often infused with agitation. And we live with a mind that has stimulation-bound attention. We can be infatuated with excitement and intensity, with drama and with events. And this is often where we feel most awake and most alive. And I think, you know, individually and culturally, we tend to be anxious about being bored, about being deprived of that kind of excitement. And I think we don't always appreciate the ways in which this infatuation with intensity and events enslaves us to the world of conditions. Our sense doors become so hungry in the endless search for gratification. Now, Joseph Campbell once wrote, "What we are really seeking for is the sense of being fully alive." This is actually a noble desire. It's actually a noble desire, but it gets subverted into a path of craving. The cultivation of joyfulness inwardly generated has given us a taste, I think, of something more profound and more enduring than the fleeting pleasant sensations and gratifications born of pursuing the world of conditions. Calming begins, I think, when we start to become disenchanted with being enslaved by our impulses. When we start to become disenchanted with distress and drama, when we start to become disenchanted with the cycles of craving and aversion that lead to distress, disenchantment is a very powerful and much used word in the Buddhist teaching. It doesn't imply a sacrifice of awe and wonder. It doesn't imply a loss of interest or engagement or dullness. It implies, in my understanding, a withdrawal of projected promise. Disenchantment is a withdrawal of projected promise. We no longer externalize the sources of happiness and joy and become enchanted with them. We no longer look at the world and plead for us it to make us happy. We no longer believe that anything in this world of events and experience holds the intrinsic power to bring the distress we experience or to bring enduring happiness. I think we also develop a growing confidence that the root of true joyfulness and happiness lies within our own hearts. Out of disenchantment, which is an understanding and not a state, we begin to calm. We begin to calm the fires of greed, the fires of hatred and delusion, begin to cool. The veiling patterns begin to lose their power. There is a shift, I think, that many of us make in meditative practice, where we begin to love stillness more than we love drama. This is a very powerful shift. When we investigate the world of events and drama that can so entice us, we begin to sense a way that drama and event making has its roots in craving and aversion and confusion. This is really a question for us to investigate. Is this true for us? How is the world of drama and events and intensity built? Agitation has powerful effects upon the ways in which we engage with the world. We can sense this in our own experience, the ways in which agitation leads to impulsive speech, to cascades of thinking and action that often take us to places far from where we wish to be. How agitation can take us into a world of regret and exhaustion. The Buddha again taught just one thing, that there is dukkha and there is an end of dukkha. And the end of dukkha begins by calming the agitation. Calming is a process. Tranquility is a process. We begin by calming the body, noticing when the body starts to move. When the body starts to move, when it's pushed by impulse and agitation. Mindfulness teaches us to pause, just to pause. What is really pushing us? Learning to cultivate those pause moments, to feel our feet touching the ground, and to be present and awake in the waves of those veiling factors. We do this in the midst of restlessness, excitability, and we begin to taste the joyfulness of stillness and the freedom of not being governed by impulse. We begin calming the mind, the thought processes. We learn that we do have a choice about whether or not to feed the proliferation, the stories that can beset us. Faced with the agitation in our thoughts and dramas, we can learn to connect with places in the body that are free from agitation, to collect our attention, to highlight stillness, to highlight calmness with our attention. What in this moment, just now, in this body, is calm? What at the moment, just now, in this body, is collected, is grounded, is easeful? It is really no accident at all that mindfulness of the body is so central in the teaching of waking up, because it can be such a powerful refuge from the storms of our thinking and agitation. In the midst of our surges of agitation, we can take our attention to our sense doors, to see, to listen, to touch wholeheartedly, and to begin to calm. I think we can learn to cultivate also restraint at our sense doors that are so activated by craving and aversion and by agitation to prowl the world in wanting and not wanting. We can learn again to be a wise gatekeeper, not only of our minds, but of our sense doors. They can be such powerful messengers of craving and aversion and agitation, but those same sense doors can be equally powerful messengers of sensitivity and appreciation. There are said to be a number of supports of tranquility. The first is solitude. It doesn't mean that we all retire to caves, and probably some of you may have had more solitude over these last months than you really wish for. But the Buddha emphasized that we can learn to be at ease within ourselves and at ease in aloneness. And that this is a powerful teaching for us about sufficiency and about calming. The second of the supports for tranquility is dispassion. And again, this doesn't mean becoming flat or indifferent, but the cooling of craving and ill will, ending our almost like our infatuation with craving and ill will, no longer externalizing the sources of happiness and unhappiness. The cooling of the veiling factors and a maturity. The Buddha speaks of a maturity in renunciation. Learning to emerge from clinging and identification. I think renunciation is a very powerful word, but it's often a word so often misunderstood. We might think instead of unbinding from everything that causes and perpetuates distress. Anyway, one of my first teachers said to me that renunciation is the greatest gift of compassion you can offer to yourself. Suzuki Roshi said that renunciation is not getting rid of the things of this world, but accepting that they pass away. Tranquility, again, is not something that some fortunate people have and others miss out on. Tranquility is a cultivation. It's a seed of potentiality within all of us to actually really cultivate the moments of stillness that we can encounter and develop, to learn to collect the mind and body in that stillness. There is a sweet taste within that stillness, within that calming, the sense of there not being anything lacking, and the easefulness that we find within it, which is so much that just the opposite of agitation. The next of these seven treasures, which is very much related to calming, to tranquility, is samadhi. Samadhi is a quality that looks backwards to tranquility and forwards to equanimity. The most accurate translation of this word samadhi is unification and integration. It has its roots in a Pali word, which is to gather together, to collect together. And again, we come to the image of the cowherder. A good cowherder gathers their cows without intimidating them or harming them, and moves them from pastures that are dried out and no longer nourishing to fields where they will thrive and be nourished. And we learn, I think, with our practice and our intentions, to gather our attention from pastures where we no longer flourish and establish our attention in places where we do flourish and thrive. The pastures that really undermine our well-being, where we no longer are nourished, are very familiar to us. The pastures of habit, overwhelm, confusion, despair, the pastures of reactivity, of limited self-definitions that don't serve us well, the pastures of judgment and obsession. None of these pastures serve us well. And we learn that we can collect our cows, we can gather our cows, and we can move them to places where we thrive, and that we thrive in present moment experience with mindfulness, with investigation, with courage, with calm, and with joyfulness. Samadhi, I mean, it's often translated as concentration, which I think is a very limited translation of this word in the way that it's used in the early teachings. Samadhi and this unification of body, mind, and present moment imbued with the awakening qualities. This is something much deeper than concentration, which we know can either be skillful or unskillful. And it's not just a meditative exercise, but a training for our lives. How to collect and how to gather, how to integrate in the service of awakening. I think we appreciate how easy it is for us to live as really quite fragmented human beings. You know, our bodies in one place, our minds elsewhere, and present moment forgotten. How easily we can live as fragmented human beings, leaning backward into the past, leaning forward into the future, or lost in preoccupations in the present. This is what we're learning to emerge from. Samadhi is in the service of emerging from this. And it's really helpful, I find, in our days, to begin to really notice, to really appreciate these moments of fragmentation, these moments of disconnection, disunification, and to have a sense of what is needed in these moments to begin to collect and to gather. One of the first very obvious ways to do this is to actually highlight the body with mindfulness. You know, the Buddha was so clear in saying that when there is no mindfulness of the body, there is no mindfulness at all. And yet the body is often so forgotten in waves of rumination and preoccupation, ignored often until it shouts at us with some form of distress. Inhabiting the body invites the mind, inhabiting the body with mindfulness invites the mind and the body to integrate in this present moment experience. This is such a practice for our lives. It's not something that can be left just to a meditation cushion, hoping that that's going to be some magical solution to fragmentation and disunification. I think this is a practice that is so important to bring off the cushion, to become increasingly sensitized to those moments of disunification and actually how to integrate and to unify in those moments, to collect and gather. I think this climate of unification, this climate of integration, it really has a taste of stillness. But I think more importantly, it is the ground where profound understanding can really begin to take root. We could almost say that the deeper the sense of collectedness and stillness, the deeper the insight. It is the place where we move from knowing conceptually about impermanence, about dukkha, about non-self, to an embodied understanding where we are learning to live in the light of these understandings. We can know about impermanence and dukkha and non-self, but still act as if we don't know. And this is one of our primary disconnections, to act as if we don't know. But it takes stillness for knowing, to deepen into understanding. It takes a sense of collectedness and gatheredness that our knowing can really begin to sink into our bones. Samadhi, in my understanding, you know, it's where the shape of our hearts, the shape of our minds really begins to change. We begin to see the shoots of resilience, of groundedness, of steadiness and spaciousness. And they're all features of the terrain of samadhi. We can see that when we don't have this unification, how deeply vulnerable we are to being assailed by difficult mind states, by difficult emotions. So there is something in the developing this capacity for collectedness, which is really strengthening the capacity of our hearts, strengthening the capacity of our minds to really stand in the middle of all things. In one of the discourses, the Buddha speaks about this quality of samadhi as really developing a mind that feels to be a true friend. Developing a mind that feels to be a true refuge. In one of the teachings, the Buddha says, one that is well trained in samadhi thinks the thoughts they want to think when they want to think them, and doesn't think the thoughts they don't want to think. That's quite a high bar, isn't it? You know, when you reflect upon your experience so far today, you know, how many of the thoughts you've had did you actually invite in? How many of them were chosen? Yeah. How many uninvited visitors did you have in the form of thoughts? To think of that possibility, it is a high bar of thinking the thoughts you want to think when you want to think them. You know, the Buddha conceived of our minds as having the potential to be creative, reflective, imaginative, investigative. And it can see to the mind's possibility to be this through the development of samadhi, that we think the thoughts we want to think when we want to think them, and don't think the thoughts we don't want to think. Our tendencies, and in the light of samadhi, our tendencies to be captured by obsession, preoccupation, and proliferation really begins to fall away. Samadhi is said to really blind the veiling factors of craving, aversion, agitation, numbness, and doubt, that they cannot set down roots. And I hope you get a sense of you know, what it means to liberate the mind, you know, to free the mind, and to develop this minding of the moment that really feels to be a true friend. In samadhi is a calm abiding. It's a calm abiding where we develop the art of being able to sustain both intention and attention. You know, in my experience of practicing and teaching, the journey to samadhi for most of us is a journey through the veiling factors that we call the hindrances. It's a journey through those factors. These are the classrooms of samadhi. I think many people in meditation practice really discover the challenge of being able to sustain attention and intention that rise and fall together. How many times have you gone to practice, you know, with the intention to be awake and present, until that intention is hijacked by a thought storm, or, you know, a craving impulse, or an aversion story, or agitation? We have the intention to be patient and kind until we encounter the inevitable lack of cooperation from the world around us. So we really see that this art of sustaining attention and intention is the art that really enables us to live in the light of our understandings, and to live in the light of what we most deeply value, to be able to sustain attention and intention. You know, and in meditation practice, this is not a question of, you know, getting 20 breaths in a row, you know, or, you know, it's not measured in that way. It's the capacity to all really stand in the ground of those intentions and attentions, and to commit to them. You know, samadhi is a practice. You know, it really is a pathway of commitment to sustaining that which we understand to be worthy, that which we stand to be liberating, healing. But I think developing this art of sustaining intention and attention is truly crucial if we are to live the life of care and compassion and wakefulness we long to live, if we are to be free. Without samadhi, the Buddha put it, we're like a fish out of water, flapping about on the dry land. It's not a very sort of enticing image. And yet sometimes we can know what that feels like. In one of the Tibetan traditions, it's said that preoccupations do not end until the moment of your death. They end when you put them down. This is their nature. Samadhi is a cultivation moment to moment. We learn to listen to and to read the landscape of our inner experience. We become attuned to the moments we're fragmented and disconnected, when our bodies are in one place and our minds somewhere else. The moment when we find ourselves leaning forwards or backwards in time, or leaning into preoccupation. We begin to taste the nature of that fragmentation, how in itself it's unsatisfactory. Sometimes it's truly painful. I think it's so important to begin to develop this kind of inner literacy about the veiling factors and when they're operating and when they're sabotaging intention. Ah, craving is present. Ah, ill will is present, or doubt is present, or agitation is present, or numbness is present. To begin to know this landscape, because it's drawing on that aspect of mindfulness of simply knowing. Because the moment that we can develop that kind of literacy inwardly of reading our inner landscape, we actually have stepped out of the eye of the storm. We actually have stepped out of the storm of identification. And we've almost begun a kind of dialogue with these factors. Ah, what does ill will feel like? Ah, how do I know craving? Where is agitation happening? Where is it not happening? Then we can ask the question, what does this need? In the midst of agitation and restlessness, in the midst of craving, the cultivation of calming, of collectedness and equanimity are our allies. In the midst of dullness, deflation of energy, virya, energy, investigation, and joyfulness are helpful. These are the calming qualities and the enlivening qualities. And I think one of the great arts of a meditative life is appropriate responsiveness, knowing what is needed just now. We learn we can always establish mindfulness in the body, establishing a home for the mind in the body, cultivating unification and integration. The Buddha referred to this as the one fortunate attachment. And I want to read you just a piece from the several discourses that carry this title, The One Fortunate Attachment. And the Buddha says, let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let them see each presently arisen state. Let them know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. The one who dwells thus ardently day by night is one who has one fortunate attachment. I'd like to take just a moment of pause now before I go on to this last of the awakening factors, so that if there's anything that's risen in your mind as a question or a query or a reflection, that this is a good time to bring it forward, if you will.
Dan has a question.
Yes, please.
No,
Dan,
your audio is not working again. How about if we come back to you? I know. I'm going to mute you now. And
if it doesn't get working, Dan, you can put your question into chat, and we'll go to it through that way. Okay.
So Phil or Christine or both have a question.
Yeah, Christine, could you elaborate between samadhi, tranquility, and relaxation? Like, there are many practices that we can use that kind of relax the mind and the body. And then on the other hand, samadhi seems more focused. Can you just comment on that?
But I think relaxation is one of the beneficial and lovely side effects of, you know, collectedness and unification and gatheredness. You know, the body softens, you know, when the sort of waves of agitation begin to calm, the body softens. You know, there's a loosening of many of those kind of knots of holding. So it's a wonderful side effect. It's just important not to see it as sort of the goal. You know, it's one of the wonderful side effects, but it's definitely not the goal. But it's so helpful because you can see when the body does relax and when the mind does starts to relax, you know, our capacity for gatheredness, it's really almost a wonderful ground in which to build that capacity for collectedness and gatheredness. So I think, you know, in samadhi, you do feel this sense of, it's an energetic sense, you know, there's very much an energetic sense. There's also an intentional sense. There's a very wakeful sense. It doesn't mean that it leaves the relaxation behind, but it's sitting alongside this sense of real aliveness, you know, real, energetically awake. I mean, obviously, you know, one of the near enemies, we might say, of relaxation is just going to sleep, you know, which, unless we're careful, it easily does sort of morph into that. And that's almost like when the body relaxes, there's almost like a resetting of the intention, you know, to gather and to unify and to collect, rather than just to slide into the relaxation. If that answers. Thank you.
And Judy, we're ready for you if you'd like to unmute yourself.
Hi, Christina.
Hi, Judy.
It's been many years since I've heard your teachings, and they're wonderful, quite wonderful. My question is, I have a concentration practice, and in long retreats, I can get very concentrated. What's the best advice for bringing that into my everyday life?
Well, clearly, you know, if a lot of your focus in formal practice is concentration, you're not going to get that same level of concentration off the cushion, you know, when you're moving through a world of you know, multiple layers of sensory impression that's greeting you. So you shouldn't anticipate that would be, you know, automatically transferable. And I don't think you're suggesting that you would. But I do think there's a question of valuing the times off the cushion in terms of samadhi. To really beginning to sense where those, you know, because concentration kind of calms the veiling factors. It doesn't get rid of them. Okay, so it's very important to acknowledge. It doesn't get rid of them. It calms them and blinds them, but it's understanding that actually really uproots the veiling factors. So I think off the cushion, it's almost like shifting into a slightly different gear. That is a very intentional space, actually beginning to really sense, you know, those shifts from gatheredness and unification into more fragmentation or division and back into gatheredness and collectedness. So it's much more reading the landscape of what is happening in your mind and body in relationship to the world of sensory impression. So there's a little bit more of an inquiry practice in that, and a shift in intentionality.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. There's a question in the chat room from Catherine. When is investigation useful during meditation when troubling thoughts come up? But, you know, I think in some of the offerings of the seven limbs of awakening, there's a question of timeliness, you know. When is the right moment to call upon one of the limbs of awakening rather than the other? Now, if there's a bit of a thought storm, this is not the time for investigation. This is the time for calming. This is the time for gathering and collecting. You don't need to worry that somehow you're going to miss out on that one crucial moment when the insight is going to suddenly emerge. You know, those troubling thoughts will not disappear. They will come back. They're just waiting for you. Huh? But it's quite good to let them just wait for you. and come to them when you're well resourced. So times of agitation, including troubling thoughts, these are the times when we call much more upon calming, upon collecting, upon gatheredness, to resource our capacity to investigate. Because without those resources, our investigation can easily just turn into a new round of rumination and obsession. Dan, did you manage yet to?
Can you hear me?
I can indeed. I can hear you and see you.
Oh, wow. This is wonderful. I don't know what I did, but I'm glad it's working. Thank you so much for being with us this weekend. It's brought me pleasurable interest. And I was interested in your talk specifically around the question of joy, because I've been trying to bring more of that into my practice, into my path. I tend to be one of those people that works hard. You described, you know, working hard. It's my default position. What I was curious about is the idea of, you talked about sensual joyfulness. And there are certainly places I go for that. I write poetry, I like to go for walks, you know, there's a whole range of things. But part of me is a bit confused between that and sensual desire, which is, you know, a hindrance. And then there's a little sort of critic inside me going, ah, you're just really bogging off into sensual desire. This isn't really about joyfulness. It's just, you know, you're just cranking up the interest in. So is there some way of kind of gauging whether I'm moving too far one way? Because I like the idea of joyfulness.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a perennial question in contemplative traditions, you know, and I don't think there's an easy answer to it. You know, as I know of a number of traditions that they're so actually confused about that distinction that they decide to take the pathway of, you know, austerity and asceticism and not allowing anything pleasant into their world, you know. And that strikes me as really, you know, not a helpful path to take. For me, one of the litmus tests to discern this difference is a sense of have to. You know, sensual craving, sensual desire has a level of imperative within it. You know, that says I need this, you know, I don't have the freedom just to put it down. And that to me is the question, the litmus test to bring. Do I have the freedom just to put this down? You know, without, you know, deep levels of disappointment and feelings of deprivation and despair, you know, can I put this up? Yes, I could put this down and life would be just fine. That's not the nature of sensual craving. It's not that forgiving around unbinding or putting things down. You would feel you would feel the impact in terms of, oh, you know, I can't have what I want, you know, or I can't do what I want, you know. So I think this is really an ongoing investigation, because I think they can sit very closely together. Mm. I also don't think the sensual craving actually really gladdens our hearts.
Right.
I think sensual appreciation really gladdens our hearts. I'm not convinced that sensual craving does. We might get a hit of, you know, fleeting pleasure or gratification, you know. But that's not the same as being gladdened. Yeah, so it's an ongoing journey, that one.
Thank you.
And a question now from Sylvia.
Yes, thank you, Christina.
Hi, Sylvia, hi.
I'm confused between two things that you said, which seemed relevant to me personally. When you were talking about negative attentive attentional bias, you said that you didn't think it was a useful place to start, that things are, as I understood it, things to sort of address the thing that you're trying to change, whether you're unhappy with yourself, right? On the other hand, when you talked about Virya, if I pronounced it correctly.
Virya,
sorry. You said that courage and focus was a good thing to have. So to me, that left me confused because okay. I feel like I need the courage to attack the most difficult, and yet you've discouraged focusing on that.
I think we just need to be careful with, you know, obviously when we have something that's very recurrent, very repetitive as a pattern, clearly it is asking for understanding. You know, it's asking for us to understand it. It's not asking to be ignored, and it won't be ignored. But I think sometimes we underestimate the ways that the kind of attention we bring is already implicated in the difficult. You know, we've somehow labeled it as being unacceptable or something to be gotten rid of or some personal description. So the kind of attention we bring is often already implicated in the issue at hand, if we put it in that direction, which is not then an invitation to ignore it. But there's a question of timing. You know, certainly when I'm teaching and people bring forward, you know, some very repetitive, difficult, afflictive pattern, and they say, oh, you know, I really need to go into this. You know, I really need to get to the bottom of this. And I say, yeah, you actually really do. It would be really helpful to understand this. But let's have choices here. Let's make this an invited exploration rather than a compulsive exploration. So when it arises and I feel that somehow I'm just being captured by it, I might just say, not this, not now. I wouldn't say not this, not ever. But I might say, not this, not now. And then actually in the most calm, spacious moment of my day, I would perhaps invite this into my field of attention and ask some questions. You know, why, what leads this to hang around? You know, what leads this to repeat? What is really the glue here that makes this so sticky? And to be able to sit with some appropriate questions without immediately wanting to answer them, and just listen inwardly to what kind of response arises. And if we find ourselves, you know, again, just sort of diving into new circles of repetition or rumination, put it down. But let's treat this pattern of distress as a kind of vulnerable being that's being asked to be understood. But it's not asked for, you know, an excavation or an archaeological dig, you know, about, you know, where does this come from? Why is it here? You know, how do I fix this? So to me, it's a question of timing and choice. You know, am I actually choosing to explore this quite consciously and intentionally, or am I feeling sort of hooked? You know, if there's a feeling of being hooked, it's probably not the right time. So the not this, not now, I find to be a useful approach to this. It will always take courage to go into difficult territory. But not to make a project, not to make an agenda, not to feel that somehow, you know, I have this responsibility to somehow fix this or make this go away. You know, understanding ripens in the right space and the right conditions. You know, it's not something that we can really push or force. I don't know if that.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, I want to just now just spend a little bit of time with equanimity, if I may. I don't want to sort of leave you with an unfinished story. So the last of these treasures. I mean, the awakening qualities begin with sati, mindfulness, and they find their fruition in equanimity or upekkha. So upekkha is both a pathway of cultivation and I think also the deepest attainment of the meditative life. the unshakable liberation of the heart. The Buddha uses the word upekkha and nibbana interchangeably. But we don't begin with this unshakability. We're deeply touched by the world around us and the world within us. And it is so important that we are deeply touched. But we can and do often feel shaken. And it's in those moments when we feel to be knocked off balance that we learn to cultivate equanimity. Equanimity translates again in many ways, but the most accurate translation in my understanding is to stand in the middle of. To stand in the middle of. Sometimes it's translated as being equally near all things. It describes a quality of balance and poise. And equanimity does not leave the other awakening qualities behind. You know, it's not a place of, it's interesting, upekkha, the word in Pali, it translates both as equanimity and as indifference. That's how closely these two can sit together. What distinguishes equanimity from indifference is that it carries with it the other awakening qualities, mindfulness, joy, calm, collectedness, and the compassion that is found in the Brahma-viharas. Certainly I think of equanimity not as a state. I think this is really unhelpful. I think of equanimity as an understanding, and it's a relational way of being with all things that really rests upon very deep insight into the intrinsic nature of change, of unpredictability, and non-self. That's the heart of, that it permeates the threads that run through all events and experiences. So it's an understanding in the midst of all of this, in the middle of all of this, the heart can abide fully liberated from the greed and the hatred and the confusion that are the parents of suffering and despair. Now we already stand in the middle, in the midst of our life with all its joys and sorrows. There's no other place that we can be. We stand upon the shifting sands of life's unpredictability and uncertainty. There are people we have loved and people we have lost. There are people that we struggle with and people that we care about. And we have no power to guarantee the unassailable safety of ourselves or the safety of those we love. We cannot choose to have only delightful people in our lives and perpetual lovely experiences. We cannot choose to have eternal health and immortality. This is the understanding of equanimity. What do we do with that understanding? How do we respond to that understanding? Because this is the life that we stand in the middle of. That we're not in control of the world of conditions. I think we've all been asked to learn that lesson so deeply over the last months. We all know that our worlds can crumble in a moment. And we know the impossibility of finding an enduring, reliable, predictable self in any moment. We know too that the events in our world, the pain and the suffering, the despair and the injustices, they touch us deeply. And equanimity is not a surrender of that attunement. We also know that as difficult as the events in our world can be to embrace, it really is the reactivity that knocks us off balance, much more than the events themselves. The reactivity of our fears, our aversions, or our insistence that life must be other than it is. The arguments we have with the unarguables. Equanimity certainly doesn't surrender sensitivity, compassion, care, and mindfulness, but it does surrender the arguments that this shouldn't be happening, that life is unfair, that life has to be different than it is, or whose fault is this? The Buddha put it that just as a great mountain is unshaken by the wind, so the heart of a wise person is steady amidst all the changes on this earth. The early teachings speak of equanimity as a way of meeting life, not disengaging from it. A way of meeting impermanence, which is rarely emotionally neutral. We grieve our losses. You know, we fear being deprived of all that we have gathered in our lives. We fear illness and death. Change has implications. It is as if everything that we encounter in this life, both inwardly and outwardly, has a simple message written upon it. Do not cling. Do not cling. We are, this is maybe sad news, we are not exempt from the first noble truth. We are vulnerable human beings. It's written into our DNA. We will age, we will experience illness and pain, and in time, we don't know when or how we will die. This is the first noble truth we are not exempt from. Now, we can meet this in all kinds of different ways. We can meet this with denial, with dissociation, with fear, or with compassion and equanimity. The Buddha speaks of standing in the midst of what he called the worldly winds with balance and understanding, praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, gain and loss are woven into every human life. It's not our fault. It's not somebody else's fault. We can learn not to be defined by the events and experiences that touch our lives. We can learn not to define ourselves by the contents of our own minds. We don't have to like loss, unwelcome change, or uncertainty, but we can learn to meet them with kindness, compassion, and equanimity. Within the world of human relationship, we are so easily knocked off balance in relationship to those that we love and in relationship to those that we struggle with. We are relational and emotional beings, touched by the joys and sorrows of others. We experience disappointment when we discover that we've invested the implicit power to make us happy or unhappy into another person. We despair when we discover that we don't have the power to totally protect those that we love from pain and sorrow. Equanimity is a hard classroom, you know? It's why we need courage. It's why we need compassion. It's why we need joyfulness, because equanimity is a tough classroom. To be fully present for those in our lives without believing we have the power to change the course of another person's mind, just as those who care for us do not have the power to change the course of our hearts. But this is in our hands. Some wonderful, you know, very helpful, I think, teachings that say, you know, life is but a play of joy and sorrow. May I remain unshaken by life's rise and fall. I care for you deeply, but sadly, I cannot protect you from distress. And then the deepest dimension of equanimity, rooted in understanding, is in the third ennobling truth, the unshakable deliverance of the heart, the cooling of the fires of greed and hatred and delusion. The Buddha, as I mentioned yesterday, was so committed to understanding the architecture of distress and the architecture of our own world of experience. Our worlds are so personal and individual, yet too often we assume them to be true, the true and universal world. Through the process of sensory information interfacing with perception, memory, emotional association, and thought, we identify people as friends or enemies. Objects are deemed to be beautiful or ugly. Events to be intimidating or enchanting. Our world of experience is shaped moment to moment by this process. Our sense of self and other is shaped moment to moment by this process, as are our views, our opinions that govern our speech and our thoughts and our actions. We cannot always rely upon perception. We will always rely upon perception to navigate our way through life. And one of the functions of mindfulness, as we've spoken about earlier, is to sever the link between perception and emotional memory and association. Instead of saying, I know you, I know this, we learn to be much more at ease in not knowing, willing to be surprised, to see anew and to learn. We let the moment tell us its story rather than repeatedly telling our story to the life around us. In one of the early texts, the Udana Sutta, which is titled In Praise of Equanimity, the Buddha taught, for one who clings, motion exists. But for one who does not cling, there is no motion. When there is no motion, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there is no craving. This verily is the end of suffering. So that's, I'd like to end on that note. We have just a few minutes before we close. If anyone wants to raise anything. So just to bear in mind, though, before we go there, to really bear in mind that these qualities are always cooperating with each other. They truly are an extended, functional, happy family. And part of the skillfulness in our practice is knowing when to draw upon one of these allies as a place that helps us to be alive, to be awake, to be responsive. So it's not linear or developmental, although clearly mindfulness is the embarkation point and equanimity is often seen as being the fruition. Equanimity is such an ally in our lives, not just as a fruition, but actually as something that we cultivate in the midst of all things.
Christine, okay. Would it be okay? We had two people who had their hands raised from the last, just a few minutes ago. Would it be okay for those two people to?
Yes, indeed.
I just invited Sheila to unmute herself.
Sheila, you're going to magically appear on my
yes.
first screen. There you are. Hi, Sheila.
Hello. Thank you so much. I wish we had full days and longer.
And me have Zoom brains.
Your earlier words about how we live as fragmented beings really resonated with me. And I felt like, in a way, that's when we practice meditation and mindfulness that we see that. And that seems similar to seeing the fact that we are the five aggregates, that these experiences arise and fade away fast, very constantly. And so that seems like it's a wise view to recognize that is what is happening. And so what is the movement from that recognition of the fragmentation and the quick changes to the collectedness and gathering.
Well, it's an intentional movement, Sheila. It's always, you know, everything in this path is intention-led. So it's an intentional movement. And I think really the response here is the most simple one. Feel your feet touch the ground. I think it's the most simple one. Feel your feet touch the ground. You know, that's something that's available to us. You know, feel your feet touch the ground and collect, you know, cultivate that sense of groundedness, of earth. And that is the beginning, really, the most, I think, the most powerful and simple step of coming out of that fragmentation.
So the body. The body.
The body. Mm-hmm. Body, the body, the body.
Mm. Not some kind of mental.
Absolutely not. You know, find the ground and then, you know, feel the collectedness begin to happen and feel how that is a healer of fragmentation.
Yes, I wasn't thinking of the fragmentation as a negative.
That's a negative, no.
Yes.
But just as that
reality.
Just that constant flux. Mm-hmm. But even within the five aggregates, of course, it's not really truly fragmented because they are all cooperating together as one whole, even though they're rising and passing. It's actually not fragmented. It, you know, there's different levels of predominance, different levels of activity. That may give the appearance of fragmentation, but the fragmentation happens when we lose that sense of their cooperative nature.
Mm-hmm. Right, see it flowing as a whole.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, there's one last one, did you say, Suzanne?
There is, from Mike in the UK, and I just asked you to unmute yourself, Mike.
Hello, Christina. Hi. Thank you. Thank you again for this weekend. This is the third weekend in a row that I've had the privilege of Christina's teachings. So,
hey, by the way, I'm here next weekend too.
Oh, right. Okay. To see what I can do.
The never ending.
Okay. So, please don't, it's fine if you don't want to take too long over this because I know we're right at the end, but I was just curious in the difference between PT, joy and mudita, appreciative joy. I always think in terms of cultivating joy, thinking in terms of mudita. And I just wondered if there was some kind of overlap or if it's just the boundlessness.
No, there's totally an overlap. I mean, it's just that the word piti tends to be associated with two things, either with meditative absorptions in terms of rapture or with appreciative joyfulness in terms of the Brahma Viharas. But actually, when you actually look at the text, PT is such a big spectrum landscape. And both of those are part of it. Both of those are part of it. But neither of those is the whole of it. You know, because the Buddha speaks about, you know, that the PT in contentment, the PT in generosity, the PT in ethics. You know, so it's such a spectrum word that it's helpful to recognize, oh yeah, it appears in this list in this particular form. Oh, and then if I go into the list of the jhanas or absorption qualities, it'll appear in that list in a slightly different form. And, you know, it's easy to get the impression, well, are these different things? No, they're different flavors of PT. I think they're different flavors. It's like going to the ice cream store, you know.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, so I think really we are at an ending. So I first of all, I want to just really say thank you to to everyone who's really facilitated this and make this happen. And I'm so pleased. I don't know how it is for you, but I think the Zoom gods have been smiling on us. I think we've had no freezing. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but my sense is we've had no freezing or faltering. So actually the Zoom gods are smiling on us. So thank you for everyone who's facilitated this. And it really has been a delight to catch sight of you.